I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Hello, Martin.
Good to be here, Michael.
Well, it's good to be alive. I'm looking out the window in Fremantle at the moment. Martin, the sky's grey, there's weather patterns everywhere, there's a cyclone a little bit north of us. It's dropped a couple of 100 millimetres of rain already on Exmouth. Grey days ahead, and I'm not even talking politics here, Martin. I'm just talking about the weather. But
I
tell me,
think you could use the weather in Western Australia as a metaphor for politics, I think.
well, there was a ray of sunshine, staying with the metaphors for the Labor Party, it seems, in South Australia at the general election held last Saturday. Remind our listeners, what did happen, and what do you make of the voting trends that were displayed?
So it was a resounding success for Peter Malinauskas and the South Australian Labor Party, who were re-elected in a landslide, which is a really strong result for them. Interestingly, their primary didn't actually change much, Michael. Actually stayed pretty much the same. Greens, I think, went down 1% or two, actually, and Greens went up 1% or two. But so that was the first story. I think he's very popular and well-liked, and he did well. But the second story is the story that everyone's talking about, and that's the surge in support for One Nation, who polled over 20%. And this is the best result in any state or federal election for 30 years. And they've outpolled the Liberal Party statewide, which is an extraordinary impact. There is no national party effectively. They ran some candidates, but they don't have a presence really in South Australia. And so I don't think they won enough seats to be opposition, Michael. There's a couple still being decided, but we're seeing a complete fracture of conservative politics, and the Liberals would be really worried. You'd have to say that the upcoming by-election in Farrow, they'd have to be raging favourites there now. It's that kind of seat. We've got another election coming up in Victoria. I suspect they'll do quite well there. That's the story that so many people are taking away nationally.
So, Martin, it sounds like you're joining a small but growing group who say something really quite significant has happened 2026 in Australian politics. Write it down, put it in the politics books now, and you'll be talking about it in another 10, 20, 30 years that something significant happened. Is that it?
With One Nation, the only thing I'd be careful about with One Nation, its history is filled with kind of messiness. So they get elected. The last time this happened, I mentioned this best result in 30 years. They did this in Queensland. They had a dozen MPs elected, which is more than what they'll get elected this time. And then promptly there was mess, distrust, bickering, fights. And almost every one of those MPs resigned from the One Nation and became independent. So actually, that didn't foreshadow a massive surge over next 5 or 10 years in One Nation. So that's my one bit of caution. The track record of One Nation is lose a lot of MPs once they get to Parliament. But for the time being, with many of the other topics we're about to talk to today, it's a time of incredible global uncertainty. We've got problems with the global food chain and fuel chain. People want Australia to become more sovereign and take care of its own business more effectively. Immigration's in the mirror, all of those things, that suits One Nation. So they've got this sort of unique opportunity to really bash up the major parties. And right at this point in time, they've been pretty successful at that.
Is it significant, do you think, that people like Barnaby Joyce and Corey Bernardi, who you might describe as seasoned politicians, a little maverick each of them, but with clear views, have joined One Nation? Do you expect there'll be some others a bit like them who will jump the fence and in a sense, add some professional credibility to One Nation, a little bit like a weak football team picking up some seasoned players and looking better?
Yeah, that's not a bad analogy. I think they're both opportunists. I think they both saw the way the wind was blowing. Corey Bernardi, in particular, this is the guy that's headed up the upper house ticket for South Australia for One Nation. former federal senator. He actually quit a year into a 6-year term to form his own party as last time. Didn't go anywhere. So he's got a bit of a track record of jumping on new wagons, and he, I think he definitely has jumped on this wagon. He was a very traditional conservative politician. I don't think I think his views have recently aligned, Michael, with One Nation.
Well, we'll continue to watch it. And as you say, the Farah by-election, which isn't all that far away now, Martin, just what, 2 or 3 weeks?
So you would expect a lot of regional rural areas where One Nation tends to poll best anyway, that they've got the edge over the Liberals. And I just can't see in a place like Farah, which is its largest urban centre is Albury. It's mostly a series of regional centres and then country, farms and the like. And One Nation would be very well placed. Actually, I've listened to their candidate and he presents well. So this is the other thing. They are starting to attract candidates that present better and probably argue more cogently some key points.
Martin, last week on the View from the Roundhouse, we talked about the possibility of the Australian federal budget under Jim Chalmers taking some new, what would seem to be, if not radical, adventurous or decisive lines. I'm getting the feeling that it might just be Jim Chalmers thinking that way. We've got Liberal Party politicians of the conservative sort suggesting that there should be, in a sense, larger taxes placed on the profits made by fossil fuel companies. Did you read that?
I did, and Andrew Hastie is really leading the charge. This is a shift, and for Hastie, to be fair to him, it's not a recent shift because he was plugging this, he was making the same points last year at least. It's shifting from a small government, more libertarian, a big business friendly approach to economic nationalism, a sense that Australia needs to be sovereign over its own resources. So to do that, it needs to extract taxes around that and then use that money to set up its own supply chains, to bring back and support local manufacturing, all of those things. So it actually paints a very interventionist picture into our local economy.
Well, Martin, he'll be quoting Ken Henry, the former head of Treasury, before we know it, a man otherwise, it seems to me, who was much hated in the Conservative ranks.
Look, it's quite fascinating to see that, and I think it's a bit of a challenge for Angus Taylor, because Angus Taylor is more of your traditional liberal conservative. He wouldn't like that, and he's also at the same time he's put out another thing today arguing for a major cut in the fuel excise, and that's all well and good, but it obviously takes you get a revenue hit from that, and also if fuel prices are rising so high at 20 cents a litre, say, cut in excise, which is all good, that probably gets wiped out the next day with the next increase in fuel prices. So it probably it's not going to make a, it's a really short-term sugar hit.
There's a headline right now in the New York Times. US stocks have their biggest drop since start of Iran war. The S&P 500 tumbled 1.7%, and oil prices continued to rise as investors fretted about when the war would end. We'll come back to the broader question posed at the end shortly, Martin. But we've got this turmoil right around the world. And we talked last time we were on View from the Roundhouse about COVID and the effect it had on people rushing out and buying toilet paper. It seems that something very similar is happening now. People are rushing out and buying fossil fuel by the load. There's been, I think, a 25% increase in demand. I mean, of course, it's going to run out if everyone runs out and tries to buy it, just as it happened with toilet paper. Am I wrong?
No, you're dead right. 25% surge in demand is 25. It's Australian consumers deciding that they're not sure if fuel is going to be available for much longer, and buying up any kind of fuel they can find filling up jerry cans and the like, and that's being banned at some service stations, and overwhelming supply. So I think Chris Bowen said that there'd been six, maybe it's, I don't know if it's still current, but at the start of this week, there'd been six out of 81 tankers not making it to Australia. That alone wouldn't cause a fuel crisis. There's certain demand has. So it just speaks to how people behave. And I think we're at a tipping point now with a whole range of other foodstuffs, Michael. You've got a situation where people are worried about other non-perishable food items going up, and they might, the pasta will fly off the shelf, the toilet paper again, and then a whole range of other things, which will push up inflation more, then create a greater sense that you better purchase things before. So people won't save, wages won't keep up with prices. So it could have a really lasting detrimental effect to our entire economy. Then you have the Reserve Bank, they'll push up interest rates again. So it really can snowball this.
Well, there's an amazingly clear writer, George Monbiot, on The Guardian, in a very recent piece. He talks about the food supplies in the world. His complaint is there'll be real problems if anyone tries to interrupt them. And he's worried about the fact that a few corporations control food supplies around the world. I mean, all of these things sort of start to come together. If you could close down the way the world economy works pretty quickly, and we don't have, probably never quite had the sort of economic nationalism that Andrew Hastie and the old-fashioned left-wing unions liked, Martin. How are we going to get through it?
Well, we haven't had it for decades.
No.
To try and suddenly change now, actually, there's a lot of fundamentals where if we decided to make a fairly significant policy shift over a matter of a decade or two, we've got a really abundant renewable energy supplies with solar, wind, etc. We've got an even wave power. We've got the ability to produce more food than we eat. Certainly in terms of cereal crops and the like. We've got a lot of other potential primary industries. We're underdone in manufacturing, but actually you could create that if you really wanted to. So Australia actually has a lot more means to be self-sufficient, but you couldn't do that in the short term. And actually would you need a lot of effort and a lot of consistency on policy over an extended time.
Well, Monbiot thinks in order to feed ourselves, the world, in geographical terms, needs to go to plant-based food. We all need to become vegans or vegetarians, Martin. It's just an interesting proposition.
Well, I can say one thing that that WA did well a number of years ago, and there was, must have been a fair bit of foresight, but there was the gas reservation policy, Michael, which guaranteed a percentage of all the gas that was produced would stay in Western Australia. Doesn't that look like a sound idea now?
Didn't it always look like a sound idea? Why do we get rid of everything when we've got it in abundance? But Martin, what we do seem to have in abundance around the world, people are making them and trying to come up with mechanisms to defend themselves from them, are drones. They've become a military thing. I've discovered recently that school kids are encouraged to get into drone racing. I think that's so that they then later seek a career in the armed forces and fly them for military purposes. But there's even talk of Russia supplying their drone warfare capacity to Iran. If that's true, the Iran war is going to drag on for much longer than we want it to, Martin.
One of the biggest winners of this to date is Russia. So Russia's done extremely well out of this current war on multiple fronts. So there's a lot less pressure on Russia to end the Ukrainian war. They can go off and attack Ukraine with impunity. And there was a mass drone attack just this week on Iran, on Ukraine, I should say. Russia's been able to prove itself a very reliable ally for Iran when few others could, by supplying them with intelligence and a whole range of other things. So Iran would be very grateful for that. And finally, Russia's suddenly had an injection of a whole range of money back into the government because the sanctions have been lifted on its oil. Not completely, but partially, and that's a huge advantage for them. So, that's they're one of the biggest winners.
Billions and billions and billions, huge number is coming into their
I heard
revenues.
140 billion. I don't know if that's right. Advantage from the partial lifting of the sanctions.
It's a back of the envelope calculation, but it's indicating to you that it's significant. Well, let's just stay with Russia for a minute. Ukraine, you've mentioned the huge drone attack. They're taking the advantage. This continues to be a lot of media stuff being leaked, obviously out of the White House, to suggest that it's time for Ukraine to give up the Donbass and try and resolve this if they want to resolve it. Does that to you seem to be what's happening?
I think so, and certainly Trump is not going to be pouring money at the moment into Ukraine, is he? It's his least concern, and European leaders themselves are heavily preoccupied with how to respond to Trump's calls for assistance, and that, they're finding that really tricky because they still know that there's something in the US alliance. I mean, NATO is their preeminent alliance. At the same time, there's a lot of skepticism on the ground amongst their own populations about getting involved here. And then you've got Trump that doesn't help because he's been out bashing up his allies, particularly Keir Starmer, that seems to be really copying it in the media, and even Australia, Michael, this morning there. I don't think he creates a lot of goodwill every time he does that.
Well, I have to say, I feel myself becoming something of an Australian nationalist, but I try not to betray my views in past episodes of you from the Roundhouse. But it made me mildly happy to hear that Trump was bad-mouthing us again. Australians really do have to think about Australia first and stop thinking about Trump. But what about the Iran war? Is it all about the Strait of Hormuz?
It's that's central to a lot of the other things going on. It's proven to be probably the single biggest jewel in Iran's crown. We make this all sound like the US is losing and Iran's winning. The US still has overwhelming military firepower here, and it's really bashed up and beaten up Iran, and their military capability's been greatly weakened. But they still, I think, for commercial tankers, the single effect of downing one of their big tankers is itself so catastrophic that the mere threat of this is stopping shipping from going through those straits. So they don't even have to physically sink ships to do this, and that's the problem that Trump's found, in that not many companies want to send the ships through at the moment because the risk is too high.
Martin, there was a bloke, he might have been mythical, called Achilles in the old days in Greece. He had a heel as powerful as he was, which was sort of his undoing. It's a bit like that here.
Well, you've got America with its overwhelming military firepower, but with its great sensitivity to the markets. Money makes that country go round, and it's the impact on the markets, I think, that's really hurting Trump. And all of his best mates are businessmen. That's who he hangs out with. So that's where the uncomfortable nature of things are, and that's why he's feeling a fair bit of pressure at home.
Martin, I've consistently said pretty much from the beginning of this Iran business, I've not seen it ending anytime soon. Planes, it seems, are getting through the Middle East at the moment in dribs and drabs. I think the Emirates flights are getting to Dubai and going out, not as many as there were, but people are able to fly if they want to and need to. That suggests things aren't quite as tense as they might be, but. We want to see an end to this. I mean, how will it come about? Would you make a prediction? Trump says he's talking to them. They say we're not talking to anyone.
I think that there's two. Trump's got only two options now. He strikes a deal with the Iranians and claims victory and walks away. I think that's his preference because it's the least risk now. But if he can't do it, he's got only one other option, and that's that to try something risky that shifts the ball game, and that unfortunately probably involves some form of ground forces not a general invasion of Iran, but some form of ground forces inserted into, say, Kerguelen Island or around the Straits of Hormuz to eradicate Iranian threats and try and shift that. I can't see him agreeing to a full-scale invasion of Iran. It's just way too much investment. But that's probably his other option. I think that's a really dangerous one for him. Anything that involves US ground forces. I think probably Iran's been thinking about this and preparing it for it for a few weeks at least as a contingency. And it could go pretty bad.
And you're not filling me with any hope. We said last time China seemed to be sitting on the sidelines watching. Trump was planning some sort of China pivot. He was meant to be going off there to talk to President Xi, and they were going to work things out and try and work out what they do with the rare minerals and other things and computer chips and the like. I'm guessing everything's pretty much, if not frozen, going very slow between China and the US. And China, once again, must, a little bit like Russia, think, well, we'll just watch this out and reposition ourselves after America's in a sense reduced their global authority and no longer have as many armaments as they once had.
Yeah, that's a fair point. China, again, I pointed out Russia's done this especially well. China's not doing too badly out of this because they're not impacted in the same way, international standing, etc. In fact, they're advantaged every time the US's international standing is diminished. Now, that's what great power rivalry looks like. However, there is a concern. I mean, they are. A huge importer of all sorts of things, including energy. And they need to ensure that global food supplies and global supply chains generally continue. So I think that they would be keen to see the conflict end as well for that reason.
Well, Martin, the times are uncertain, but if you're in Tel Aviv, they're not really uncertain at all. This is what you've been waiting for, your chance to clear the borders, to make Israel, in a sense, impregnable, reduce, if not the enmity, then the real risk of your neighbours being able to hit you hard. There doesn't seem to be much of a let up by Israel in all of this.
No, I mean, Israel's running to its own schedule here and its own agenda. And I think that's another worry for Trump because they want to eliminate the Iranian regime ultimately. And if they can't eliminate the regime, they will use as much force as they can to deplete it further, to undermine its capacity, etc. Their war with Iran is more existential. They also have used the opportunity now to get stuck into, because Hezbollah fired at them, to get stuck into Lebanon, the southern part of Lebanon, occupy it. They're talking about that, and try to eradicate Hezbollah. So that's, escalated another way. I can't see them being very keen on wrapping this up anytime soon. And so in the event that Trump does manage to negotiate a peace deal, he's still looking at trying to rein in Israel and making sure that they don't start something up again.
And at the same time, he's extended the time for acting on a threat to hit the energy sources to the 6th of April. So it gets extended and extended. I mean, we predicted at the time he first made a threat to do something dramatic that Iran would just laugh and say, "Oh yeah, go for it," and
Yeah.
they made their own threats. I mean, it seems like schoolboys who've only got sticks and stones in one sense, taunting each other.
I think there's a saying that I've heard people say about Trump: don't listen to what he says, listen to what he's doing, right? And the threat from Trump, if you look at what he's doing, he's actually bringing a whole range of forces, Marines, into that immediate sphere for potential deployment. So while he's talking about hitting energy sites, and he still may do so, we talked about why that's a really dangerous proposition because Iran may hit other energy sites from all across the Gulf, etc. Then you've got a really big global energy problem. Alternatively, if he tries some, targeted specific troop deployment, maybe that's the alternative that he actually does rather than what he's threatening to do. He likes being unpredictable, doesn't he?
Oh, he loves being unpredictable. It's part of his strategy. Wants to be an unguided missile, and he's pretty good at it in that sense. Martin, when are the midterm elections?
Midterm elections are in November, so we've still got some way to go for them. There's time for Trump to try and sort this mess out. Reopening the Straits of Hormuz would allow the global economy to settle down by November, but wrecking the energy infrastructure, that's I don't think see how you repair that by November. I think that, that's the difference. That's where, the whole global supply chain would be in a mess if that were the case.
And Martin, we know that there's a federal budget not far away here in Australia. Have you had any more thoughts on what the Australian government will or can do? It seems to be with the hasty sort of intervention, maybe across the aisle agreement that some dramatic financial taxation revenue measures are called for.
I think there's definitely two things which we hear all the time. It's the removal of the capital gains discount. That's basically a tax concession for the profits you make off buying and selling houses. Then the second part is the second thing that's emerged more recently is a newer tax on extended tax on gas. They're making a lot of profits. They're not subject to the same mining resources tax. The one that Gillard introduced, Michael. So they've probably got a better run than some of the other areas at the moment. And that, together with the high price of gas, has got people thinking. And Andrew Hastie's support for it probably makes it a bit politically more easily, because even if the Liberals were to oppose it, generally, that could be pointed to. Certainly the Greens you'd think would support something like that, and help with its passage. I think, your David Pococks and the like would probably support that too, Michael. So you could see that getting through. And in this climate and environment where we need to shore up our resources more effectively, Michael, I could see it being reasonably popular.
Well, it's been another week, Martin. We, in a sense, tread water. We watch on what happens out of the US. Is there anything Australia can do to assist the president's thinking, to otherwise prepare itself along the lines you've discussed, I suppose, for what lies ahead, either in the short term or the medium term?
Well, I think it's very difficult to influence the American administration at the moment. I think they're running to their own schedule, and even major European allies are not really making a difference. I think to the extent that he's listening to any allies, it's probably his Gulf allies he's listening to more often than not. But I think the best thing Australia can do is keep calm and not overrun on our supermarket shelves, Michael, and not overreact.
Well, on that positive piece of advice basis, Professor Drum, we'll end today's view from the roundhouse. Keep an eye on the Cyclone Narelle that's coming our way, and hope that we survive till next Friday.
Always a pleasure, Michael.
See you then.